Good morning. This is my first time preaching on stage, that is. I preach all the time at home to my wife and the kids. They all love it when I do, so I'm expecting you'll do the same. If I were to ask you, what is the book of the Bible that you've read the most, what do you think the answer is going to be? I'm not asking what's your favorite book of the Bible. I'm asking, what is the book of the Bible that you've read the most? Think about it. If I'm guessing, it's probably Psalms, probably up there. Genesis. Any others? The Romans, the Gospels, Revelation. Wow, I didn't think you read Revelation before bed every night to see what. Yeah, for me, it's probably, I think someone mentioned Proverbs. Yeah, I read a lot of Proverbs for years. I've been reading one a day. I don't know, I can't remember where I got it from, but the idea is there are 31 Proverbs and then there are 31 days in a month, 30, 31. So what you do is you just pick a proverb. Today is, for example, today is the 26th. You just open it up and read 26 of proverb. And, whichever day it is, you just read that proverb. And the cool thing about it is the consistency. It doesn't matter, because if I forgot or things got busy and I missed out on one day, and then the next time you go, oh, what's God speaking to me through Proverbs? And you just skip to whatever that day is. This allowed me to continue on with this practice. Rather than, say, we're dieting, and you eat a cookie and go, oh, forget it. That's done. I'm not going to do that anymore. This allows me to continue on with practice for years and still do. The other thing about proverb is every passage, every proverb is a standalone message. You don't have to remember, oh, what was I reading? Oh, what the story is? Everything is standalone in there, and just glean from the wisdom God gave us, and it's been quite helpful. So that is my topic for today, is the book of Proverbs. I'm going to focus on chapter 1, in particular verse 1 to 7. Proverbs 1 to 7. I'll put it up there, we can read it. The proverb of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. A fool despises wisdom and instruction. Let's go through each one, and starting with verse 1, it says, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. So this verse is giving us a bit of a background story of Proverbs. It's telling us it's Solomon's Proverbs, and he's the king of Israel, and he's the son of David, King David. Pretty simple there. Can someone tell us who Solomon's mother was? Bathsheba, that's right. Yeah, I can't remember when I found that out, and I was like, I didn't know that, and it made an imprint on me, because it's if you think about it, it's remarkable. We all know the story of David and Bathsheba. And somehow, you know, God was able to use that story and produce this, you know, that broken story God was able to use, and all the way connect that the dots and leading to Jesus. That's the royal line of Jesus' lineage. And it was in the prophet that Jesus, the Messiah, will come from the tribe of David. So I got this, the genealogy from the book of Matthew, and that's where we were told that Solomon's mom was Bathsheba. You can tell the connection there from David all the way to Jesus. On the left-hand side, that's all the kings. If you're interested, you can read on them in 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and Chronicles. Each of them has an account that was recorded. Coming to the right-hand side, Jeconiah, he's the last king before the Babylon siege. They were taken to exile and for about 70 years, and until Jerubbaal took the people back to Jerusalem. The name Jerubbaal actually means born in Babylon. He was the seed of Babylon. He was born in Babylon, and then he took people back to Jerusalem. And then after him, all those people we know very little about, other than in Matthew we were given the genealogy and we know who the names are, but that's about it. Sometimes we were told these are the years of the silent years of about 500 years. People were just trying to survive under different world powers. First the Persians and the Greeks took over, and then the Romans, and people were just scattered, scared, and they're very small tribe. I think when they left Babylon, they were roughly about, you know, some say around 100,000 people. That's it. So they were trying to, Jerubbaal, you know, they were trying to build a wall, try to protect themselves, and try to repopulate the city, and it set the stage for the Messiah to return. People were ready for someone to rescue them. So that's the story there. But I'm trying to make the point, you know, if we are trying to create a story, you know, from David to Jesus, will we use Bathsheba to be the key person in that story? Probably not. We'll want to find someone that, you know, a bit perfect, you know, not with such flaws in their character and stories. Even just, and you wouldn't necessarily change the storyline. You know, we know David had about 8 wives. You know, anyone will do, right? It doesn't have to be Bathsheba, but from that we can see that God can use us even when we make mistakes. It doesn't matter how messed up we are, God is saying it's okay. You know, throughout the Bible, God tells us that he can use us. All the heroes in the stories are flawed people, and that's the good news for us. We can be like one of those flawed people and still used by God and loved by God. So that's my point. Okay, so back to Solomon. He was kind of famous. What is he famous for? Wisdom. And someone said, wives. So how does those two things connect? I was talking to Chris. I was like, I read something interesting the other day, talking about marriage, and it's saying, you know, marriage is really good for people, and men and women, but especially for men, because men, the study shows, when men got married, we are a lot more valuable at work. We make better decisions, and we're more mature. We we make more money because of it. They say on average, same people when they get married, or compared to same age group, same role and everything, married men make 10 to 40% more money than single. Okay, we're a lot more valuable at work. And that's right. take note there. And also, we are more healthy too. You know, they say when we get married, for men, we typically live 3 to 5 years longer because we're married. Thanks, dear. And you kind of understand why, if you think about it. We're good at some things. We're not good at some things. We're good at taking risks. You know, be out there and conquer and whatnot. But we're not good at taking care of ourselves. So with the counsel of our wives and whatnot, we live longer, and that makes sense. Although some people debate about that. They say, you know, you don't actually live longer, you just feel like you live longer. So Trevor kind of hit my point there. If you have a wife and that make you more valuable and wise, so 1,000 wives, 1,000 times more wise. There you go. We actually know how he was wise, and let's look at it. We were told in 1 Kings 3, 7 to 9, he had an encounter with, Solomon had an encounter with God, and it's actually in his dream, interestingly, that he was given the opportunity to ask God for whatever he wanted. So let's read this, 1 Kings 3, 7 to 9. Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father, David, but I'm only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? And you can see that his attitude there is very admirable. He goes to God and say, look, you know, I'm only a little child. I don't know anything. Who am I? I'm nobody. I'm your servant. And I know I need to govern your people. And I don't even know what's right and wrong. So help me here. And no surprising there. God was very pleased with his asking, and this is what God's response was. And this is God speaking, I will do whatever you have asked. What you have asked, I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime, you will have no equal among kings. So God made Solomon the wisest man who ever lived. And that's his title. You know, he says, both now and there will never be. So you know, there won't be another person that's as wise as Solomon. And because he didn't ask for anything else, God grant him wealth and honor as well. That's a pretty good deal. So wealth and honor, you know, we can think of, about those two as two kind of things that drives us in our lives. Wealth kind of represents our desire for pleasure, for let's say, and honor is our desire for to be noticed, to be admired. Neither things are wrong, but when it's our asking in our life, if we put it at the highest level, that's an inward focus. Right? We kind of know people like that. We probably have some of that in us, but when it's pushed to the extreme, that's not good. We probably know people, they're working and they're gathering. Their life goal is to, retire early and sit on a beach and, that's their life goal. That's the wealth represents. And then there's the honor. And there are people who really don't care about the wealth and what they can get. The material thing doesn't really interest them. What they do interest in, however, is people look up to them and to be noticed and to be admired for what they do. So that's the two types. But Solomon shows us there's a better way to live life, which is to govern God's people. And that, in a sense, is to aim up towards God. He's offering himself up to God's will. We're told if when our focus is right, God will bless us. Not only that, he will also give us wealth and honor. So it's kind of, when we serve God, he will give us what we did not ask for, but it's also good for us. And it's kind of, Jesus used the saying kind of illustrate that as well later. It says, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So that's the background of the book of Proverbs. Well, much contains the wisdom of Solomon. It also includes contributions from others. Some sections from 22 to 24 are attributed to a group known as the wise, the wise says. And Agur, son of Jake, is credited with the saying in chapter 30. And King Lemuel, we don't know who he is, but in chapter 31, Proverbs 31, wives, know about that one. So he shares his wisdom, the wisdom taught to him by his mother. And the book of Proverbs was compiled over time as a collection of timeless wisdom preserved and passed down to for the benefit of future generations. For example, in Proverbs 4, the tone reflects of a loving father teaching his child. Proverbs 4:1 says, listen, my sons, to a father's instruction. Pay attention and gain understanding. This parental tone runs through the book and emphasizes on that relational and practical nature of biblical wisdom. Let's read down to verse 2. It says, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight. So what's the purpose of reading Proverbs? It for gaining wisdom, for understanding words. See the key word here, and the action words is for gaining wisdom and for understanding. So the two key words here. So it emphasizes on learning, growth, which shapes our understanding of the world. But why? Why do we need that? Proverbs 1-3 shows us that. For receiving instructions in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair. So it tells us that it helps us to produce prudent behavior. It helps us to be more prudent. Notice here, prudent behavior, again, emphasizing on the action here. It helps us to do better. And then again, doing what is right and just and fair. Just track with me here how many actions here he's using. Doing what is right and just and fair. So most of us are familiar with the great commandment. So in Matthew 22, one of the Pharisees, expert of the law, asked Jesus, saying, teacher, tell us, well, he's trying to trap Jesus, saying, tell us the greatest commandment. And Jesus, and typically, he answered them not with exactly the way they asked, but he's like, you want one? I'll give you two. First, you love God, and then second, you do what? Love your neighbor. Yeah. And then Jesus said, if you do those two things, you know, all the laws and prophets hang on those two things. So basically, if you do those two things, everything else will take care of themselves. I believe there's an Old Testament equivalent to this passage, and that's found in Micah 6:8. So in the Old Testament, in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, there are lots of laws governing the people, and people counted out there are 613 of them, things that you do, things you don't do, and a lot of the times people either ignore them, or they find it too much, too burdensome, and as a result, you know, they live in a life very legalistic, and God spoke to the people through Prophet Micah, and this is what God said to people. He has shown you, O mortal, sometimes it says man, translation, so O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. So in a sense, that's why I see it as similar to the Great Commandment. The two things you need to do right, whereas here it says, just do these three things and everything will take care of itself. It says, what does the Lord require of you? So what can we do our life well? Just those three things. Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with God. So the first one, act justly, it echoes what we were talking about earlier, doing what is right and just and fair. So on the surface, you may think, oh, like, of course, we all know to act justly. Why, you know, we know right and wrong, but that's the wisdom of God. He knows us, right? He, just like we know our kids sometimes. I have five kids, and if you have little ones, you probably can relate to this. I've heard so many times when they say, oh, it's not fair, okay? And you think, oh, he's concerned about being fair, you know, act justly, check. But when do they actually say it's not fair? When it's not fair to them, right? You know, it's not fair. My sister got whatever. And sharing is another thing. I remember teaching one of my kids, you know, share this, you need to share. And one of them said to me, but I want to share all by myself. So God is teaching us here, see the word, again, action word, act justly. He's not addressing our understanding. It's not like we don't know what's fair, and it's our nature. He's saying you need to overcome your nature. You need to act justly. That's what he's trying to get at here. And let's be honest, our nature doesn't change unless we address them. It's the same. I use the example of kids, but we are the same, right? We don't like to act justly. We like things just when it's in our favor. I can use the example, I think we hear the complaint, you know, 90% of the world's wealth is in the 10% people, and on the surface, it's kind of people saying, oh, that's not fair, it's not fair. But if you look deep into it, who are making these complaints? It's people who are in the 10%, right? In a sense, they're not saying, look at these poor people. What they're saying is, there are people more rich than me. You know, that's not fair. Because the poor people, I'm not saying if there's inequalities and we shouldn't address them, we should. But the poor people aren't really the ones that making that claim, because they are quite happy, frankly, in life. I remember, Brian, just before, when you were sharing in your testimony, you were saying, I can't remember where you went on a missions trip, and third world country. You know, people can't afford beds. You know, there's not enough beds for people to live in, sleep on. They have to take shifts to sleep, but they were happy. And that's my experience too. You know, growing up in China, when people were poor, it didn't affect them day-to-day life. They had purpose and they took care of each other. And the material wealth actually did the opposite. You know, now people are, you know, trying to protect what they have, that hasn't resulted in a positive life experience for them. Okay, Proverbs 1:4. For giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Okay, so simple and the young, that kind of makes sense. So God is, Solomon's making a distinction here. For people who are starting up, the standard is different. That's why we teach our kids and we continue to learn and grow. And you know, my 4-year-old Sophie draws pictures and you know, mostly with squares and circles, and she'll do that and then she'll, "Dad, look, that's you and me." And you know, it's, for a 4-year-old, it's pretty good. And at least you can tell, you know, there's one's, you know, slightly taller and one's slight, you know, that's me and her. That's good. I was like, "Oh, good job." But that's not standard we apply to, say, a 10-year-old or 20-year-old. And that's the idea here. When we're simple, we're young, we're starting up, it's okay to not be as wise. And then as we continue to learn and grow and learn and gather things in life, we become wiser. Okay, it continues. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. Okay, so let the wise. Who are the wise? Are we the wise? I think we can be. Solomon is not like distinguishing, you know, there are two types of people in the world. One's wise, you know, and then the other group is unwise. So if you're wise, you know, listen. No, he's not talking. It's an invitation. So like everybody should listen and add to their learning. Later on, I think Jesus used the phrase, "He who has ear, let him hear." He used that a lot. Again, he's now saying, you know, there are people who've got 2 ears, you know, they can hear well, and then there are others without ears, they can't hear well. He's saying, you know, everyone, listen up, add to your learning, and grow in wisdom. And the key word here, is to add to their learning. Why do we need to add? Because the wise, the marker of a wise person is they know that out there are things that they don't have, right? So that kind of shows that attitude. You need to continue learning and growing. Imagine if it doesn't look well on ourselves if we look back a year, 5 years, and 10 years, and you go, "What have I learned?" And you search, you know, there's nothing, you know, I haven't learned anything over the last 10 years. And I'm not talking about we learned, you know, how to send that emoji or something. It's, we have to be learning something, you know, change us fundamentally, that we see God in a different light. You know, God doesn't change, that's true, but our understanding of him should change over time, and we should be continuing to learn and grow. I heard a quote recently, it hits mark for me. It says, "Standing firm does not mean standing still." Okay? Standing firm does not mean standing still. We can be firm with our understanding of God, who he is, and we need to look up to him, but our understanding of him should continue to grow and help us in our lives, because we all have blind spots and we need to address them. And how? By adding to our learning. Okay. Okay, Proverbs 1:6. For understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. Okay, proverbs and parables. Jesus used a lot of parables when he's teaching. And I just love it when he speaks parables, and then later he tells us, you know, and the disciples, they didn't understand it. We were told, you know, they didn't understand it. That makes me feel better, because after 2,000 years and after all the wise people go before us, we can look up, we can see the histories and exactly what happened, and all the references, and we can look up and still there are lots of things that we don't understand. You know, we need to continue to add to our wisdom in order for us to understand. For a long time, I struggled with the book of Job, because it seems strange to me that everything was taken away for Job, including his family, unjustly, right? It was unjust, because we were told he was blameless, and everything was taken away from him. But somehow, you know, our understanding is we were told, you know, God somehow is still holding him in his hand, and he's in control of everything. For a long time, I didn't understand that. It's like, it's not useful. I what do I do with that? But, you know, as I was learning and growing, and there are things in there that start to make sense to me, and once it starts to make sense, it's a good tool I can use to apply to life, and so that's a good thing. Maybe I'll share that what I learned there one day. Okay, last. Okay. Last one here. Proverbs 1:7. So, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instructions. Okay, so in Proverbs 9:10, it says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that's the one I'm more familiar with when I hear, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's the one that I remembered. So I actually looked it up to see if it was a translation difference, but apparently there are two different words in Proverbs 1:7 and 9:10. So that brings us to the discussion about knowledge and wisdom. So what are the differences there? So one analogy I heard is knowledge is knowing a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is to know not to put it in a fruit salad. I actually heard that from Jane Butler. Here's another one. This one I like even more. It says, knowledge is knowing, it's like having a map in your hand, and wisdom is to know that where you should go. Okay, it's like having a map, that's knowledge, and where you should go, that's wisdom. So as followers of Christ, we have a distinct advantage. We should have a clearer sense of where we should go. Our life purposes should align with God in such a way that we pursue things that other people don't know God, just don't understand. That we understand that. One example is that in general, and this is not debated, religious people tend to have more children, right? As society becomes secular, there are less kids produced. So, if judging by that standard, you know, we're very religious here at Webster. We're doing well. Some of you are doing your part. We're done, but keep going. Okay, so I want to address one final point. I want to go back to King Solomon. So we know that he was wise, and he had 1,000 wives. It wasn't a joke earlier. So what? How did those two things go together? It's an important question, because we want to figure out things. If we can figure out some things, then it becomes useful. It's like a good tool. So if you remember from children's story time, Krista was teaching the kids First Kings, and she used this picture. So that's King Solomon. He's got a half heart is red, half the heart is black. So representing all God half-heartedly. And the right side of the heart represents, you know, what he did was right, asking God for wisdom to lead his people. And God was pleased, and that's the right heart, right side of the heart. And then the black side, it represents that he did not follow God. Why? He acquired all these wives, and because of it, introduced all the pagan worship and idol worship, and as a result, split the kingdom in half, and you can see the bags split in half, and he's losing all his treasure. So that's my question. What is the benefit of having wisdom if it does not lead you to a good life? Because Solomon is the wisest man who ever lived, and that's not an arbitrary title. It's not like we say, oh, so-and-so is so wise. He's the wisest man, we were told, and God gave him that title and said, there will be no one like you. So he's the wisest man, but he did not end up well. So what's going on here? So I realized that something, this is the answer. So wisdom alone is not everything. It's not the be-all and end-all. It needs to be paired with action. That's why I keep pointing when I was reading Proverbs, action, 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 it needs action. So go back to our analogy earlier. Knowledge is we have the map in hand. Wisdom, we know where we should go. But does that automatically lead us to be there? No. So the action is key here. We have to overcome our nature and actually move to get there. To use another example, I think we all know if we exercise, exercise is good for us, right? We all know that. And we all know if we eat less sugar, if we cut out all the junks, that's good for us, right? And some of us know that we can lose, we can stand to lose a few pounds, right? Maybe not Jim, you look good. But to know what we need to do and to know what we want to do, does that automatically lead us to be where we want to be? And this truth is reflected in 1 Kings 3:14. So after God blessed King Solomon, he said, "And if you walk in obedience to me and keep my decrees and commands, as David your father did, I will give you a long life." So God separated wisdom from action. Walk and keep is key here. So it says there's a condition. So even though that's after God gave him wisdom, and he said, "If you walk in obedience and keep my decrees and commands, then I will give you a long life." So Proverbs 1:7, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and wisdom, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." So I think there's our answer. Why did Solomon, being the wisest man, end up in the state that he was? Is because he despised wisdom and instruction. That's the warning for us. We can be wise, and we can, you know, despise wisdom, even though that we know what we should do. Okay, so see what we can pull from applications. First is, if we were to ask God for anything, what will we ask him for? So Solomon was given the opportunity to God said, whatever you ask me. So if this is our position, ask for whatever you want me to give you. And that's from God to all of us. What do you think we will ask him? What should you ask him? Think for a second. What if I say that this question has actually been asked for all of us? Okay. The way we live our lives, in many ways, is our ongoing answer every day through our choices. We are expressing to God what we are asking him for. Where do we invest our time? Where do we invest our energy? What problem are we trying to solve? That's what we are asking God for. To use an example, if we pay attention to our spouses, what they need, we're asking God to bless us with a good marriage. We read up on books on marriage and try to identify the areas that we need to change, not where our spouse is strong. We need to change. We're asking God to bless us with a good marriage. And if we make time for our kids to read to them and to play with them, to build into them, we are essentially asking God to bless us with healthy kids, right? I've heard kids spell love with the letters T-I-M-E, right? They need our time. Or more technically, they need our attention. That's what they're asking for. But time is kind of an accurate representative of our attention, although we can't be there and not be there. So just because we're there doesn't necessarily mean that. That's why I'm saying our attention is what they are seeking. That's why sometimes they act out. They don't get good attention, bad attention will do. They need our attention. We only have about 20 minutes a day individually with each of the kids we have. Okay, that's on average. When our kids are little, we may have more than 20 minutes, but and when they're teens and as they grow up, it's less because their schedules start to come in if they have jobs and whatnot. So, but 20 minutes of individual time is the average of what we have each day. So that 20 minutes each day is an opportunity for us to build into our kids and make a difference if we want to have healthy kids. And ideally, that 20 minutes should be something like a time of play, right? What do I mean by that? That play is when everything, all the environments are right. So we get together, imagine it's like on a date, leave behind all the troubles and whatnot. They're just ready to invest into each other, They're there to learn and grow and have fun with you, and you're there to ready to build into them. But we're probably not going to manage that, because with any play, there's lots of things that can interrupt that. If the kids are too hungry, too tired, play probably won't happen. That requires us to have a structure in our home. Proper bedtime and dinner at regular place, all those need to happen. We're fortunate. I get to have meals with my family, three meals a day. I'm pretty blessed in that sense. But some people may find it hard to achieve. Sometimes I've heard people who never have a meal together ever. What else? If we have had a bad day at work, that's going to affect that, right? We're going to take the trouble at work. Things that stress us will carry that and bring that with us. So that's going to play into that 20 minutes window. When I was in China, working in an accounting firm that's quite demanding, I heard a manager of mine saying that his newborn daughter, who's a year old, pretty much hadn't met him yet, because he leaves at 6 o'clock in the morning every day. But I mean every day. There's no Saturday Sundays, you know. Leaves at 6 and travel an hour to work. Start at 7 whatever, because he's a manager. He got to get things ready for the team, and then he doesn't get home till 8 or 9 or whatever. The newborn's asleep by the time, and that's 7 days a week. So there's no time. His daughter doesn't know him. Okay, and or if we had, you know, we're having dealing issues with our boss at work and whatnot. So we'll bring all that into our time with our kids. How about financial stress? If we're not in a position that we're financially things are under control, that's going to bring stress for us. Financial stress is number one factor that drives divorce, apparently. It's not hard to understand. What about our relationship with our spouses? I think if I'm having a bad relationship with my spouse, you know, what happens when we spend time with our kids? All going to play a part in that time. We want to ideally invest in our kids. So I don't know if, and there's other things, you know, health, if we're dealing with health and stuff, everything can play into that. So I remember watching It's a Wonderful Life when George, was his name George Bailey, when at the end there when he was so stressed, you know, lost the money and couldn't make it pay, and basically that's the end of his career and meaning for his existence is try to carry on that family legacy, and he was just lashing out to the kids, you know, and I can relate to that. We all do that. I do that. Sometimes I feel bad after, but you know, our kids they can't win with us. It doesn't matter, you know, whether they're right or wrong. If I'm in a bad mood, I'll destroy them. You know, it doesn't matter what argument they have, and so those things are important to be reminded of. So when you think about all these things together, you know, every single area I mentioned kind of make us realize it's huge. Each individual thing will take probably years to figure out and put it together in a way that it's manageable, and to combine all of those, it will really drive us to pray to God, you know. And we can probably map up to the prayer that Solomon asked God for. It is a prayer. Whatever we ask God, it's a prayer that we pray to God. You know, he says something like, "We know God. We know you are good, and I'm your servant." It says, in a sense, acknowledging that our ability is so limited. We are nothing without Him. You know, God gave us this opportunity of managing this people, you know, our people. We in a sense, we all have a community. We all have a kingdom. None of us live just by ourselves. If we're married, if we're single, it's our close relationships, families, and friends. And if we're married, that's our spouses and kids. You know, it says, God gave us a number of people too numerous to count. And I look at my family, and say, yeah, their number of kids, you know, it's too numerous to count sometimes, especially come bedtime. It's like, okay, three down, two more to go. You know, there are a lot of them. And yeah, considering all the things we need to put together to so that we can act, you know, in a way that that is helpful to them, it becomes a huge task. And that's what Solomon is asking here. You know, I'm nothing, God. I'm your servant. I know I'm doing this thing that you asked me to do, and it's you put me in the position because I'm leading this group. And I don't know right from wrong even. Sometimes when we hit wall, you know, we feel like helpless. That's what he's getting there. We don't even know right and wrong. You know, we just don't know what to do anymore. So, and yeah, that's the prayer to God. That's our prayer to God. And it's interesting that it was all these happened in his dream. What does that mean? You know, we were told it was in his dream that God appeared to him, and he asked him. God to bless him. I think whatever preoccupies ourselves during the day, it tends to start deep into our dreams. We kind of know that because sometimes we ask people, you know, what is your dream? What's your dream job? You know, because we think about them. If we think about them all the time, and we dream about them, and that's a way to kind of conceptualize that. I know a guy who had a terrible fall, and as a result had a spinal cord injury, and he's now what's the word? Quadriplegic. Yeah, he can't move at all, and. But in his dream, he's moving. Okay, so when he's waking up and he says, he tells the nurse, quick, take this cup from my hand. I'm going to spill it. You know? And the nurse like, no, you can't move. It's whatever preoccupies our mind, it comes in our dreams and we think about them. And that's my understanding. So Solomon's asking of God is, because he's preoccupied with the task he had in hand, is to how to govern his people, and all the complications comes along with it, and he's burdened, and he's asking God, and we can do the same when we put something, you know, what we're struggling with, what problem we're trying to solve in our lives, and that's what we are asking God for. Hey. Our goals, our life goals reflect what we're asking God for, what I'm pursuing. Okay, the second application, pursue wisdom and growth. We need to pursue growth and add to our learning. You know, the mark of being wise is to know that we don't know enough. So it's not a state that we arrive at. It's not, you know, finally I'm wise now. It's not like that. It's, you know, it's a process. We need to keep adding, learning, and growing. And the last one is take action. And we talk about, you know, wisdom without action is nothing. And remember, God's warning to King Solomon says, if you follow my command, I will bless you. So if you follow my command, I will bless you. Not, you know, if you're wise, I'll bless you. Or if you know what to do, I will bless you. No, if you will follow my command. So I hope we can all be counted as blessed, not because we're wise, but because we acted on them. So that's the three things I want to leave with you. You know, what are we asking God for with our lives? And keep adding to to our wisdom, continue to grow, and finally, take actions with our life. Thank you.